We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're back, we're dads on the air.
And welcome back to Dads on the Air, this 18th day of October 2011, and it's a bright sunny day in Sydney. And this is Bill Cable from Mediate Now, and in the studio with me this morning is Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com.
Good morning, Bill. Good morning, listeners.
And we've got a very big show today. It is Mental Health Month in New South Wales, and following on from the interview we did last week with Heath Cole, who's out there on his bike doing something for mental health. Today we will be speaking with federal politician Andrew Robb. That'll be coming up at 11 o'clock. And following Andrew, we will be switching to speak to Rebecca Lewis from Are You OK? This is a very successful movement. It's been going for 3 years now, and it's a simple thing to do, and it's having great effect, and it's just encouraging people to speak to friends, neighbours, associates, everyone, and just say, are you okay? It might mean having a cup of coffee, having a cup of tea, and get that feeling as to how people are travelling. So anyway, we'll be getting a bit more information about that growing movement with Rebecca Lewis, and that should be coming up about 11:30. So in this Mental Health Month in New South Wales, there is a lot happening, and and perhaps I might just we might go to some of the other news that's some to do with mental health and some with other events that are coming up. And first of all, I might just say a big thank you to Warwick Marsh at Dads for Kids Fatherhood Foundation. He sends out a weekly newsletter. If people are interested in getting that weekly newsletter, I'd encourage you to go to the Dads for Kids website, and you'll find all sorts of items and news stories and what Warwick's been up to and what people generally concerned about fathers and children are doing. It's a wealth of information in that website. And if you go to this week's website information, you'll find that there is a Dads and Kids Family Bush Camp coming up. Once again, by popular demand, the Family Bush Camp, just for dads and their kids. Kids, ideally between the ages of 4 and 24, is on again this year on Friday the 4th of November. There'll be a few staying on Saturday night as well. That's on the 5th of November. It's being held at Wallandilly River Station, which is, if you want to find out about Wallandilly River Station, you can go to its website, which is www.wallandillyriverstation.com. It's a scenic spot about 50 kilometres due west of Mittagong on the banks of the Wallandilly River and 10 kilometres from the Wombian Caves. The cost for this camp out, very reasonable. Dads, $10 per night. Kids, $5 each per night. And you just need to bring your camping equipment, some food and some swimming togs, because after the campfire at night, you wake up to a morning with swimming and games to accommodate all ages. It sounds like a lot of fun, but you must book with Phil Costa. Now, to book, you'll find all this information on the website, but if you want to make a booking with Phil Costa, you can either ring him on 0466 008479 or go to P. Costa, that's P-C-O-S-T-A-R, at gotooutback.com. pcosta at gotooutback.com. So people interested, that sounds like a fantastic time on the Friday the 4th of November, the Family Bush Camp. And Ian, you got something there for us?
Oh, I do have something here. This is a little bit amusing. This is from Saturday's Daily Telegraph. Kiwis are hot for their chance to procreate history. Angela Mollard has written her article. This is, of course, pertaining
To the Rugby World Cup. Turn my mic on there. That'll help. Angela Mollard wrote in the Saturday's Daily Telegraph, never mind Costello's one for mum, one for dad and one for the country. The Kiwis are poised to deliver one for the All Blacks, with 96% of the population saying they plan on having sex if New Zealand wins the Rugby World Cup. And if that young Aaron Cruden delivers some Dan Carter-style moves and Richie McCaw's dodgy foot comes good, all that victorious shagging will lead to a massive sprog spike come next July. So there you go. So there's some, a lot of the New Zealand population, because it looks pretty well they are on track to win the World Cup, having defeated Australia last Sunday. Now with only the French blocking their way, it looks like a pretty reasonable bet that there's going to be a population spike in New Zealand to come next July.
Spoken like a true Kiwi. That's the rugby news from Ian. And yes, it should be a great match next Sunday. Now, coming back to our theme for the month of the Mental Health Month in New South Wales, there is going to be an evening seminar on Wednesday, the 2nd of November 2011, put on by the Australian Association for Infant Mental Health, the New South Wales branch. This is going to be held at the New South Wales Institute of Psychiatry, Lecture Room 7, 5 Fleet Street, Parramatta, and it'll run from 6:30 p.m. to 9 p.m. with a light supper provided. The speakers are going to be Dr. Daniel Paquette from the University of Montreal in Quebec, and also Dr. Richard Fletcher from the University of Newcastle in New South Wales. Dr. Fletcher has been a guest on this program, and we would thoroughly recommend this night to find out a bit more about the differences that are evident in father-infant attachment. Now, we hear a lot about the mother-child attachment. This is actually what have we learned about the father-infant attachment? So people, you can welcome to go to this seminar. As I say, it's presented by Dr. Daniel Paquette and Dr. Richard Fletcher. The cost for the evening, including the light supper, is for members, AAIMHI members, $10, for non-members, $20, and it's payable at the door. For all bookings, and we'd recommend that you do make a booking, please contact martha.birch at nswiop.nsw.edu.au. Or you can fax a form to Martha Birch on her fax number, which is 02984938838. I'll just give you that fax number again, 02984938838. That's a very interesting evening coming up on the Wednesday, the 2nd of November.
Okay, well, I've got another one here. This appeared in last week in the Telegraph last week. Better off with a ring was the heading. Men who marry are less likely to die from cancer than their singleton counterparts, researchers have found. Hakon Kravdal of the University of Oslo and Dr. Astrid Seiss of the Cancer Registry of Norway compared survival data for cancer patients diagnosed between 1970 and 2007 to their marital status. They found unmarried people had a greater risk of death regardless of age, education, the site of their tumour, time since diagnosis, and cancer stage. However, the risk of dying early for men who had never married was worse than it was for women. So there you go. So getting married would appear is a healthier option, especially for men.
Yes, I think that's been confirmed in a number of studies. So that's an interesting finding. Interesting this week is that our own Phil York, who's been a regular on this program for quite a long time, Phil is the coordinator in New South Wales of the Dads in Distress Service, DIDS, very well known, and Phil has found himself on the program with, being mentioned in the program Australia's Next Top Model. DIDS have said they're fortunate enough to appear in the media in various mediums, but this is probably the first time they've been on Australia's Top Model. The aspirant said that she wanted to dedicate her appearance in the show to DIDS. So
isn't that nice?
That's
very good.
A very good cause. We're always promoting DIDS on this program. It does wonderful work, and Phil York is a mainstay of DIDS, as I say, the coordinator in New South Wales, and it's great to see him getting mentioned again on TV, and that's
becoming a regular multimedia superstar as our Phil.
He is. He's moved on from radio to TV, and who knows what's next.
Yeah.
He's also, of course, been in the Tropfest Film Awards. I don't know if Hollywood's next, but anyway, that's our Phil.
That's our Phil. Well, I've got one here. This is from last Wednesday's Telegraph, basically to do with this this boy who got busted for marijuana in Bali. Rosie Squires has written under the heading "Mum's Lonely Vigil at Jailed Son's Side." She sleeps in a wooden chair, chain smokes to while away the hours, and refuses to leave her 14-year-old son's side. This is the Australian mother in the middle of her own living hell in Bali. She's been holed up in a room adjacent to where her son is being held at Denpasar Police Headquarters for the past 8 nights as Indonesian authorities decide his fate. She emerged for the first time yesterday to make several calls on her mobile phone. Her only connection to family, including her husband, who is back in Australia reportedly to gather key medical evidence for his son's defence. I mean, what an absolute nightmare that this family is going through, from this young boy who wandered off and bought some marijuana off somebody on the beach. I mean, a completely ridiculous scenario. You really got to ask the question, I mean, if the police can get a young 14-year-old boy buying the stuff, why don't they bust the bloody drug dealers in the first place and nip all this? And, you know, why should it have gone this far that they bust the boy? You know, and surely they should have gone for the drug dealers, one would think.
Yes, it certainly does raise quite a few issues. And while we're on the on that issue of children being incarcerated, an issue raised by Mike Carlton in his weekend column was that we in Australia have incarcerated many children who have been involved in this people smuggling racket. They get roped in to be crew on these boats, probably without any great understanding of what's involved. They finish up in Australia and then they are put into indefinite detention behind barbed wire fences in the various detention centres around Australia. What are they doing there? That's, I think it's time that that we looked at the whole question of this mandatory detention. Of course, it's been in the news a lot lately with Julia Gillard unable to force through her proposed legislation. There's now going to be onshore processing, and we all wait to see what is going to come out of this complete reversal of policy.
It's a political minefield. I mean, let's face it. I mean, neither party has a. What I would call a sensible policy. I mean, the fact is, I mean, most of these refugees have rights guaranteed them under the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, which are being denied to them when they are mandatorily locked in, you know, behind razor wire in detention centres, basically imprisoned in Australia. They're not criminals. They have a right to a refuge because they do come from war-torn nations. A majority of them do genuinely fear for their lives, and they qualify as refugees. They qualify for us, our compassion, and for a safe haven, which Australia can obviously supply. I mean, the numbers being touted are very small compared to, you know, what we could or couldn't handle, especially if you compare them with what the Europeans are dealing with due to the crises in Libya and Tunisia and the, you know, the Middle Eastern spring that's going on with refugees coming at Europe from all sides. I mean, we are dealing with paltry numbers here, and the whole way that we're dealing with this issue is xenophobic, and it really does bring out the worst narrow-minded white Australian, you know, throwback headspaces, you know, the Pauline Hanson type of headspace, which we really need to evolve away from quickly.
Yes, I mean, there does seem to be a model with asylum seekers that arrive by aeroplane. We know how to handle them. It just seems to be the emotion involved with people arriving on boats.
And why boats? I mean, the numbers are so small. I mean, what's the big phobia about people who arrive on boats because they can't afford an airline ticket, you know? I mean, surely they're more needy, they're more desperate. You know, locking any children, you know, in any kind of detention situation has been proven to cause mental problems for them. You know, it's not a humane way to deal with fellow human beings who are desperate, in trouble, and in need of our compassion and help. And that's what they come here looking for. And what do? We treat them like a bunch of criminals, call them queue jumpers, and lock them up behind razor wire and criminalise them. I mean, it's ridiculous and it's obscene.
Yep, I think there's no doubt that there's a great amount of hypocrisy involved in this whole area. Now, moving on to events coming up in connection with the Mental Health Month in New South Wales. There is a workshop coming up, actually, well, this is in Brisbane. It's on November 22. It's for Working with Men Affected by Violence training program. It's being run by Greg Milan, and he's looking for a few more registrations for this event to go ahead. As I said, it's on Tuesday, November 22, 2011, and it will run from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Diana Plaza Hotel, 12 Annerley Road, Woolloongabba in Brisbane. The program is for health, wealth, welfare and community workers, and it provides information and strategies for working with men who are affected by violence in their relationships, and it presents a model for this work. The areas covered in the program will include the background to the problem and the context of violence, and where violence and abuse occurs, the effect of domestic violence on a person and what's different for men who suffer from domestic violence, the strategies for working with men from a strengths-based perspective, a model for working with men affected by violence, and building services for male victims of domestic violence into your agency, what you need to consider. So, look, these are very important areas which are going to be dealt with in this violence training program. As I say, I commend it to you. It's Tuesday, November 22, in Brisbane at 12 Annerley Road, Woolloongabba, Brisbane. For more information on this seminar that's coming up, go to the Men's Health Services website, and you'll find all the information there and how to make a booking and get along to that program.
Okay, well, I've got another one here from last Wednesday's Telegraph. Angry and Violent When Girls Go Bad is the headline. Catherine Danks has written, they are angry, unsupervised and increasingly turning to crime to get attention. And they are female, Sydney's growing mob of lawless teenage girls. Experts have reported an alarming upward trend in the number of girls breaking the law, with the aggressive nature of the crimes worrying police, magistrates and child psychologists. Bureau of Crime Statistics and Research data shows the number of female juvenile offenders increased by 36% in the 10 years to June 2009. Child psychologist Dr. John Irvine said it was worrying that more young girls are committing crimes, noting the aggressive nature of the offenders. He said, 14-year-olds, they have the bodies of adults but the vulnerabilities of children. They need boundaries, supervision, even though they don't want it. Too many of these kids are wandering around at night and are getting more and more extrovert in their displays of attention-seeking, he said. So, yeah, gangs of young women marauding around the place, stealing cars, assaulting people. It's becoming epidemic. An increase in 36% is significant in 10 years.
Yes, it is. Just moving on again now with another event that's coming up. This year, the Man Alive Festival is being held on Sunday, the 6th of November. This is for people in South Australia. It's being held again at the Semaphore Foreshore from 10 a.m. till 4 p.m. For anyone unfamiliar with the festival, you can check out the link, which is if you just go to www.manalivefestival.com.au, and that should give you a good idea of what it's all about. The festival celebrates the positive contributions that men make in our communities, because men take on many roles. They take on those, including fathers, sons, workers, carers, protectors, and lots more. So this festival provides an opportunity to say thanks to men for what they do every day for us, for the community. And a central part of the festival is the Man Alive Award. People from South Australian communities are invited to nominate a male they know for this award. And the nominees may be volunteers, they may be just great dads, they may be dedicated workers, or anyone who you want to nominate for this Man Alive Award. The award epitomises the feel of the festival, whereby families can come along to a free event to enjoy themselves while saying, thanks, fellas. So go to that website. There are nomination forms there. You have to get your nomination in by Friday, the 21st of October. And if you're able to get along to that festival, it sounds like a lot of fun. That's on Sunday, 6th of November at Semaphore. I don't know if I pronounced that properly before. It's S-E-M-P-A-H-O-R-E, Foreshore. In South Australia, so that sounds good. One other thing we'll have to keep mentioning, well, I'll just mention it now, we'll mention it again before the end of the show, but we have a new website address. It's www.dadsontheair.com.au. Now, if you go to that site, you'll get the shows each week are uploaded onto that site, and there are also archives, and there's a lot of other information on that site. So don't forget www.dadsontheair.com.au. That is the right address for this show.
Okay, well, I've got one more here. This is from the Sun Herald last Sunday, under the heading "When Parents Select Baby's Sex, Experts Push to Lift Ban on Choice." Cosima Mariner has written, "Parents should be able to choose the sex of any baby after their first child to gender balance their family," says a leading Sydney obstetrician. The head of Women and Children's Health at the University of New South Wales, Professor Michael Chapman, says Australians are more concerned about achieving a desired ratio of boys to girls in their families than wanting firstborn sons. "In this country, it's more about gender balance than selecting the sex of one child," he said. To forestall moves towards designer babies, the federal government in 2005 banned parents from selecting the sex of their embryos via IVF. Professor Chapman said that before the ban, less than 5% of IVF parents asked to choose their baby's sex. Of those who did, there was an equal preference for boys and girls. So it would appear that he's come out in favour of choosing your child's sex, provided you you're only wanting to balance out your family. And what do you think of that? You know, that, I mean, this is the old, you know, how much power should parents have to be able to design their families? In this case, justifying it, if your first child is a girl, presumably you'd like to have a boy for your second child, or vice versa. If your first child's a boy, you'd like to have a girl for your second child. I mean, should parents have this plan? I mean, nature has denied us this choice for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And now in the last 10, we seem to have managed to wrest this choice away from nature, and we are actually able to make the decision ourselves. I don't know. Well, I guess if it's not affecting the baby's health by making the choice, I mean, I guess it, why not? You know, we have more choices in this day and age. It's just another choice, isn't it? Another thing that we can wrench away from nature and make a conscious decision about.
Yes, I have some reservations. I think in this area, I'd probably rather leave it to nature. I don't have any great faith in humanity making these sorts of decisions.
We're just leaving it to chance, really. I mean, you know, it's the XY or the XX chromosome. I mean, it seems to be a 50-50% chance which way it goes. I mean, the fact that you are now able to influence this 50-50, you know, possibility. I guess if you've got the power to choose, then why not let people use it? I mean, there doesn't seem to be a moral basis for refusing people, you know, a choice like that. And it's not like in China where everybody chooses to have boys, so you get generations where they're all boys and all the young girls are getting strangled at birth and terrible atrocities happening to young babies just because they happen to be born female. I mean, it's not a question of that sort of prejudice going on here.
Mm. You know? Well, yes, there doesn't seem to be any call for legislation on this topic. I guess we'll just have to watch and see how it goes, and if controls need to be brought in, I guess someone will have a look at it. No doubt people will rush in to make new laws. People love making new laws. Now, I've got time for a couple more items to mention here. There's first of all, a note from John Flanagan, a regular visitor to this show. John is the Deputy Registered Officer of the Non-Custodial Parents Party, Equal Parenting, and John's been monitoring the progress of the Family Violence Bill that is currently going through the federal parliament. The original bill almost passed through both houses of parliament in May and June, but it was stopped. And what is of greater concern is that the Labor Party and the Greens are now seeking to make the bill even tougher for children to have contact with both parents after separation or divorce. There's, just as one example, John quotes the removing of the original wording, which was, if there is any inconsistency between family violence and contact, that family violence issues would prevail. Well, the amendment is getting rid of any concern about inconsistency. They're just going to take that section out. John sees these amendments as being linked to equal pay for women, which seems to get invoked in all sorts of unrelated areas these days. But it is of major concern, in the words of George Christensen, MP for Dawson, who's also been on this program. This bill is a Trojan horse, and that's the way he described it. If only we could get those sentiments that are from George Christensen out to his colleagues and stop this draconian legislation going through, we'd definitely be all ahead. So that's John will no doubt keep us up to date on progress of, well, if you call it progress, of this bill. We can only hope that sanity prevails before it goes too much further. I might also mention, just from overseas here, also President Obama has made a new proclamation on the National Domestic Violence Awareness Month 2011. And as is typical with politicians in this area, he has made some mistakes on several key facts regarding men, women and domestic violence. And these have been pointed out by the Harvard-trained public health specialist Ned Holstein from he's from fathersandfamilies.org in the US. President Obama said that one in four women and one in 13 men will experience domestic violence in their lifetime. I suppose this is a little bit of progress, because at least he's acknowledging that some men are going to experience it. The problem is that his ratio is all wrong. Instead of being 3 to 25, it's actually more like 1 to 1. And men comprise about a third of domestic violence injuries and deaths. For more information on the local situation, of course, you go to the 1 in 3 website, which has got all the real information in this area. The most recent large-scale study of domestic violence published in the American Journal of Public Health surveyed 11,000 men and women, found that according to both men's and women's accounts, 50% of the violence in the relationships was reciprocal, that is, involved both parties. And in those cases, the women were more likely to have been the first to strike. Moreover, when the violence was one-sided, both women and men said that women were the perpetrators about 70% of the time. Now, the real reason for the concern about getting these figures wrong is that the myth that only men do it is going to distort the actions taken to reduce all violence. I mean, we are against all violence, not just men against women, but also women against men, women against children, men against children. The whole range is...
anybody against anybody. Yep. We're against it.
We just want to get rid of this.
We don't think violence is a good thing.
Yep. And, you know, by having this myth, oftentimes the victims are the children who end up in the care of violent mothers and are deprived of the guidance and nurture of loving fathers. So it is of concern. It's good that people like Ned Holstein are getting in there and getting up on the real facts. Okay, we'll go to a short break.
Live up here, but you know that it's not family and it's not home. What of a darling wife that once I had? Well, I'm pleased to say that she still talks to me. But I try not to think of what went wrong. 'Cause if I say that I was right, she might say that she was right. And the only rights I care about are visitor rights. Yeah. On any other day, I might care what you say. But every Saturday is Father's Day. You might call it sad, you might call me mad, but I've got one who calls me dad. We go where he wants to go. We do what he wants to do. I tell him everything I know, 'cause I do.
They grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
Dad's in Distress. 1-300-853-437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air. Welcome back to Dad's on the Air. This 18th day of October 2011. And our special guest now is Andrew Robb. Andrew Robb is the Shadow Minister for Finance and Debt Reduction. He is the federal member for the seat of Goldstein, better get that pronounced properly, and is the author of a recent book, Black Dog Days, Public Life, Private Demons. Andrew Robb, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, Bill.
Could you tell us, first of all, how do I pronounce the name of your seat, the federal seat?
Well, it's the person who it's named after, Velda Goldstein. That's how she pronounced it, but it can be pronounced either way in Germany, I understand. Oh. It was, yes.
Well, that's good to hear. You've been in the news now, particularly since the launch of your book in August, and I guess it goes back to August 2009 when you declared publicly that you were going to be taking a break from your ministerial role. Your shadow ministerial, wasn't it? But,
that's right.
That must have been a big decision to go public and to take that 3 months off.
Well, it was a huge decision for me in a way. I suspect, you know, I'd spent much of 43 years denying even to myself that I had a depressive condition. I'd talk about my morning problem, and in fact, I put it down to just not being good in the morning for so long, and then what was a morning problem got later and later and later as I got older. And in the end, I was being asked to consider a position that, would have stretched me a lot further and would have meant that I had to be on my game 24/7. And finally, I decided I couldn't. By then, I'd confronted it, was taking medication. It wasn't working, so I thought, I've got to keep at this and keep experimenting, and the only way I could do it was to get a bit of space, and therefore I had to make a decision about telling the world, something I'd been avoiding for so long because of the stigma that's attached to any sort of mental health condition.
Yes, and with that stigma, you've been very frank and honest in both in the book and in public about what you've been going through. And I think it's described as a diurnal variation.
That's correct, yes. For me, and it's true for quite a few other people, but the type of depression I have is I go to sleep, or I did go to sleep, I don't now, but I've now had 18 months where my life is as it was in the first 12 years of my life, but for that matter. But what used to happen was I'd go to sleep taking on the world, very positive, planning the next day and probably happy with what I'd been doing in most cases. And then I'd wake up quite the opposite. I'd have no confidence. I'd not want to engage with anybody. I'd be very negative and I wouldn't want to make decisions. And that's the way I'd be originally for 2.5 hours. But as I say, as I got older, it went out to 5 and 6 and sometimes 7 hours. And my problem was that I produce serotonin, which fires you up for the day much later than most people. And it wasn't until my body had the right levels of serotonin that I would switch and become the opposite. You know, I'd be decisive and optimistic and ready to engage and all the rest of it. So it's sort of been the pattern of my life for a long time.
Yes, and I must say, when I first heard about your decision to absent yourself from the shadow ministry for an indefinite period, I think initially, and I did wonder that you ever would be able to come back, but you've come back bigger and better and stronger than ever.
Yes, well, that's why I've written the book. Really, I thought, if I can nail this thing, it's hopefully will give encouragement to others too, that you can have a depressive condition. And nowadays there are lots of treatments, and not everyone will succeed, but there are a lot more people nowadays who will find some medication or some other approach, you know, whether it be all sorts of things to do with body cycles or light treatment or any sort of psychological, lots of psychological approaches now. There's all these combinations of things that they're now finding, can have a real material impact on your depressive condition. And you can come out the other end in better shape than you've ever been, and you can sustain it. So I denied it for so long and managed it, if you like. I had all sorts of bizarre strategies to try and, you know, keep myself positive and lift myself out of the funk that I was in. And I think there are hundreds of thousands of people, in fact, walking around who are managing a condition, have not told anybody, and whose life could be very materially improved if they went and had a chat to somebody and saw what they could do to remove that depression.
Yes, I remember one of your stories was that you put a pen in your mouth as you were driving in. So if I see someone walking in the street with a pen in their mouth, I'd
That's right. Well, I spent years going into bookshops, and I'd always buy books on positive thinking. Of course, I'd never pick up a book on depression because I didn't have it, you know. Mm. And but the books gave me all sorts of hints on how you might release endorphins to make yourself feel better. And one of them was that if you laugh or smile, and it does release endorphins, and it does improve your mood immediately. And it also said in this book that if your face assumed the characteristic of a smile, even if you weren't smiling, but if you screwed your face up as though you were, the brain got this message and didn't know that and assumed you were smiling. So for 10 years, I drove 20 minutes from outside Canberra into the city, and I'd have this pen in the mouth. I don't know what people driving the other way thought, but anyway. I did those sorts of things and tried to get myself into some sort of shape before I got to work, and I was in politics. Often there was sort of acrimonious meetings at 8 o'clock in the morning and whatever, and I needed to get myself into some sort of shape for it.
Yes, and some of those homegrown methods, I understand you continue with. You like to get a bit of sunshine, and well, I suppose that's the main one. And colours, I think, affect you as well.
Well, the sunshine is a great thing, I think, for anybody. I mean, it's a proven fact around the world that it helps everyone's mood if you can see a fair bit of sunlight. So even to leave your blinds open at night so that when you wake up, you know, the sun's coming in or the light's coming in, it can have quite a significant effect, because there is there's a blue part of the light spectrum which, when it hits certain cells in your eyes, certain cells have got nothing to do with your eyesight. They're cells that pick up that blue part of the light spectrum and again send a signal to the brain that it's morning and you should start to produce more and more serotonin, right? So, and this light actually goes through your eyelids, because, you know, if you close your eyes and look at a bright light, you'll see some of it. And so even when you're asleep, if you've got the curtains open, you can find that you're telling the brain to start producing serotonin. So when you wake up, you can feel better than you might otherwise have.
Interesting tip. And just with your frankness and honesty in discussing the problem, I'm just interested. Les Murray, who the poet laureate, has declined to talk about the black dog very much because he thinks it might wake it up. But have you ever been concerned that it might come back by talking about it so much?
No. Mine is most distinctly a chemical problem. They discovered that I do release, as I said earlier, the chemical start to produce serotonin later than others. In fact, I was given an electronic pill, and it took 2 days to go through me, and they strapped a receiver to my chest, and every 10 seconds it transmitted my core body temperature. And after it was finished, they mapped all this, they graphed the core body temperature for 2 days, and the psychiatrist said, well, there's your problem. Your core body temperature's hit a minimum between 6 and 7 in the morning. He said, for most people, it hits a minimum around 2 a.m., and evidently, when your core body temperature hits a minimum and starts going back up again, the brain is told, start producing serotonin and stop producing melatonin, which is what you've got in your body overnight. So here I was 5 or 6 hours later than everybody else. So they had to find a medication which you know, tried to change that situation. And it took a lot of experimentation, because it's quite an inexact science, the brain. There's still a hell of a lot they don't know about. But there's quite a lot of medications out there. They just don't know what fits you and what level of the medication. So I went through 6 or 7 months of trial and error, and sometimes the side effects of those medications can be really quite debilitating. Your body gets used to it, but then you find out whether the underlying condition has been fixed. But you have to have a lot of patience, and you have to be prepared to, you know, try different things. And then with a bit of luck, most people will find something which allows them to manage it, or actually, you know, overcomes it altogether. So, no, once he told me it was fixable, there was nothing stopping me.
This is Professor Tiller, who eventually came up with the right dosage and the right chemical, I imagine.
Indeed, yes. Mm. John Tiller is a great fellow, and he also introduced me to other things. He said there's lots of things that 20 years ago would have been seen as witchcraft, but which now have some role. It's not just taking a pill, but, you know, but people know that, you know, I swim 1,500 metres a day, so people know that exercise can help you. People know that the sunlight, there's a lot of natural things that can, in combination, if you keep doing these things, it complements whatever medication you might have. Even things like acupuncture works for some people, right? So he said to me, there's no one thing. In fact, he introduced me to a person that dealt with this sort of blue light of the light spectrum, and I got big doses of that every morning through a special little panel of things they gave me. So I tried all sorts of things, because once I thought I could find myself without this morning problem, there was nothing going to stop me to try and fix it, really.
Yes, and we're speaking with Andrew Robb, the Shadow Minister for Finance and Debt Reduction and the author of Black Dog Days, Public Life, Private Demons. Now, Andrew Robb, in this book, it's also quite autobiographical, and you go back to your early days in Epping, north of Melbourne, and then when you moved to Reservoir. You raise the possibility of there having been a trigger for the onset of the depression with a mother, Colm Kill, I think her name was.
It was a bit up. Well, I had in year 7 and year 8, they were, for me, really tough years. And also, during that time, we moved from our dairy farm, which I was very attached to. And we moved into the suburbs for the first time. Now, I don't know, but it was the first time I realised, or that I can remember, where I was starting to feel very depressed in the morning. In year eight, in fact, I remember walking to the train at 7:15 on many, many mornings, and desperately wishing that I was one of the retired old fellas who might have been going to pick up his milk at the shop or get the paper. And I'd be really down in the dumps and wishing my life was, I'd gone through life, and I was at a retired stage. And when you think about it, it's fairly sad. But I would find that, three-quarters of an hour later or an hour later, I would have popped out of it, and I'd be fairly normal then for the day. So that was my first memory. But I had a year with a particular nun, and then a year with the Christian brother the next year, and both of them, I think, were in their 70s, because even then they weren't getting people entering the orders, and they probably were well past their best time of teaching and tolerance. But it was the long days and lots of homework, and lived in fear half the time because of the way things were happening. But and the move from the farm, I don't know. It's usually there are things that trigger a situation. I mean, I was one of 9 children, and my mother said I was the happiest of all the 9 as a child. And then they noticed in my teens that I went quiet in the mornings. They just put it down to hormones and all the rest. But clearly something happened. I'm not sure what it was, but I think they say 75% of all depressive conditions do start in the teenage years. And if they're not dealt with, they get progressively worse as people grow older.
Yes, because really, looked at objectively, you've had a lot of support, a lot of strength. I mean, you come, as you mentioned, and you refer to it in your book, you've got 8 brothers and sisters. You've got loving parents and supportive parents, and now you're married happily, and you get a lot of support from your wife and your children, and you've had a spectacularly successful career in business and politics and lobbying, and yet against all that, you were suffering with this condition every morning.
Well, I think there are many, many people out there who've got this sort of situation. It was fascinating after I did make it public 2 years ago, when I was starting to try and find a solution. I got quite a lot of notes from captains of industry, some people who are responsible for tens and tens of thousands of jobs, who basically said something to the effect of, welcome to the club. Mm. So a lot of those had obviously privately dealt with it. I was in a public office, so in a sense I found myself, I didn't think with any alternative but to explain why I was taking some leave to try and fix a problem, because I didn't want to, start telling porkies, because you start doing that, it always catches up with you. So I thought I had to level with people. But for a lot of people, they don't have to go public about it. But I think you do, if you think you've got a problem, you do need to share it with people you trust, if it's your partner or your kids or friends. Get a little bit of support around you. But you don't necessarily have to tell the world. You can go off and, you know, take some long service leave or whatever you need to do to try and find the right solution and get yourself on the right track. But confronting it is half the battle, and there is always this fear that there's a stigma. And in fact, you know, there's been a stigma where mental health has been seen, I think, as a character weakness, and that you're not reliable and that you're not good under pressure. Well, of course, the opposite was true for me, and it must be true for a lot of others. I think as I wrote the book, it became obvious to me that I'd spent my life and made decisions about jobs which involved more and more adrenaline, because the more adrenaline I got, the more pressure I was put under, the more I was confronted with, you know, debates or arguments and all the rest, the better I felt, because the adrenaline helped me overcome the deficiency of serotonin in my body, and I searched for it. You know, when I was doing earlier in my life long research projects, which had me by myself much of the day for some months, I was in a much worse space than when I was doing things where I was being challenged and I had to debate or negotiate or whatever. So you can't assume that people who've got some sort of depressive condition are necessarily any more or any less reliable than the next person, because people said once they found out, how did you run all these political campaigns? Mm. And in fact, they were the best times for me, because the political campaign usually runs 33 days, and I'd had 33 days when my body was pretty much full of adrenaline the whole time, because there's a crisis a minute, and I'd look forward to the campaigns, because I was in good shape for most, if not all, of the day.
Yes, well, certainly you like a challenge, because I think from 1997 to 2001 you went to PBL and worked closely with the Packers.
I did. That was a great experience. You had to be on your toes with Kerry.
Yes, I don't know how you go if you said, oh, I don't work before 9.30.
Well, no, you'd walk into his office and you'd feel the adrenaline pumping, I can tell you, before he even opened his mouth, because he's a fascinating, he's a complex sort of character. But certainly, if he thought you didn't know what you're talking about and you were trying to feed him a line, he'd be all over you. He could smell it, and for the next hour, you'd wish you'd never said anything. But, yeah, it was a great place, in my view. They did things. They make things happen. They looking for opportunities. And, again, it fitted the sort of needs that I had for, you know, a lot of pressure, really, mm-hmm. and the adrenaline pumping. And, again, I was in a better space.
Yeah, and yes, and wonderful training for just about everything. And I notice that you've also been involved with the Big Brothers Big Sisters mentoring organisation. Is that do you confront people on the other side now who have got this problem?
Well, I was on the board of that for several years. When I stood for Parliament 7 years ago, I was on the different hospital boards and other things, and I stepped aside from all of them. But in the years that I was involved with Big Brother Big Sister, which I think is just an outstanding organisation, so many of the young people that were teamed up with a Big Brother or a Big Sister, they were clearly, you know, already suffering often some sort of depressive condition, albeit in its early stages. And to give them meaning to their life and hope and interest and aspiration, which is what, and confidence really, and self-esteem, all of those things gave them the tools, I think, to often work their way through those early problems that they had. And I just think, you know, worldwide it's just the most outstanding organisation that has touched the lives of hundreds of thousands of people over the years.
Yes, and that no doubt led to, was part of the, your being awarded in 2003, the Office of the Order of Australia and Centenary Medal for your service to agriculture, politics and the community. And I'm just amazed at all the different positions and the work you've done over the years in a number of different areas. But going back to your book, which it starts and it really ends with the same scenario, I suppose, of where you refer to being sounded out to stand for the leader of your political party. I guess the difference is now that you would be in a position to go for it now.
Yes, well, my time might have come and gone, but we'll see, because I think Tony Abbott's doing an outstanding job and he's got 110% of my support. But at the time, it was 2009, and you might recall Malcolm Turnbull had his Godwin Gretsch moment, the situation with an email, and a lot of colleagues were not certain that he would successfully see his way through to an election, and they were casting around to see if someone might be interested to be available if that's how it transpired. So a lot of them were approaching me to consider it, and probably for the first time in my life, because it had been getting worse and worse as well, I started to think, could I meet the responsibilities? I was certainly interested, but I told everyone I'm interested, but I'll think about it. And what I was thinking about was, would this mourning problem really preclude me from doing properly the responsibilities? And because leader of a political party is a 24/7 job, and you really have to be on your game from about 5:30 in the morning to set the day up and respond to things that have happened overnight and all the rest. And so you need to be positive and on the front foot. And I came to a conclusion after a few weeks that that it was incompatible. But for the first time, really, I felt I've struck a position that my condition is going to preclude me from doing it properly, and I'll make a goose of myself sometime down the track if I did put my hand up. So that's really what forced me to finally confront it, and that's why I feel there's probably hundreds of thousands of people out there who've got some sort of condition which they're silent about, managing it, but have probably got to a position in their workplace where they know they can manage it, but don't want to try and go any further, don't want to push it. Yet if they dealt with the condition, perhaps they could do even more with the talents that they've been given. So it is very important, not just for the individual, but I think it's important for productivity and, people making the most of their lives and perhaps enjoying their life as best they can too, if they can consider, as I say, not necessarily telling the world, but dealing with it, confronting it, going, getting some professional advice, and having a bit of patience about trying to find the answer, but sticking with it and seeing it through.
Yes, and I guess the issues there are getting some professional help, but also speaking to your family, and in particular. And I guess that's what the concern with this program is, that with fathers involved in family law situations, they might come down with depression, and of course the wife and the family are gone, so it makes it doubly difficult for them.
Of course, yeah. Well, it's certainly the sort of thing that I'm sure for quite a lot of people, quite a lot of men over the years, it has been a precursor to some sort of depressive condition. It is these sorts of traumas that seem to lead to people developing a depressive condition. And it is important if you've got people around you, but even if that is restricted, it can just be friends. But the important, I think, thing is to confront it, and but often to effectively confront it, at least one or two of the people who are close to you in whatever way need to be able to, I think, understand it and know what's going on, so that they can be a support mechanism while you're trying to find the right answer.
Yes, and Andrew Robb, we're running out of time, but I might just mention again your book. It's a wonderful book. I think Patrick McGorry describes it as a compelling account with showing your incredible strength and determination. The book is called Black Dog Days: Public Life, Private Demons, and it's available through Melbourne University Press at your local bookshop, $34.99, and it is confronting and inspiring. Andrew Robb, thank you very much for coming on the program today, and we wish you all the very best as you continue now on the right path, and we're looking forward to all the great contributions you can make to Australia in the years to come.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thanks, Bill.
Thanks very much.
All the best.
Thank you.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone. Help. When I was younger, so much younger than today, I never needed anybody's help in any way. Now these days are gone, days I'm gone. Not so self-assured. Now I find a change of mind and open up the doors.
Star Partners Fairfield, committed to helping you in buying, selling and leasing. Our commitment to service.
Guaranteed.
Our excellence in understanding and meeting your needs.
Guaranteed.
Our dedication to achieve your dreams confidently.
Guaranteed.
Call Murphy today on 9727 7799. starpartners.com.au. Star Partners Fairfield, committed to helping you in buying, selling and leasing.
Sponsor 89.3.
They grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air. Welcome back to Dads on the Air, this 18th day of October 2011. And our next guest is Rebecca Lewis, who is the project manager at Are You OK? Rebecca has worked in communications for a federal mental health program targeting multicultural communities and also has a background in radio broadcasting. But now is, as I said, the project manager of this wonderful new movement, Are You OK? Rebecca, good morning.
Good morning, Bill. How are you going?
Well, thank you, and thank you very much. I know you've got a busy morning. You've got a press release out, and you've come out of a meeting, so we really appreciate you coming and talking to us.
No problem at all.
Now, Rebecca, this Are You OK? You've only been around for a short time, haven't you?
That's right. So this year, Are You OK? Day celebrated its it's the National Day of Action on September 15th. But Are You OK? They actually grew out of a conversation between two people. One was Gavin Larkin, whose story was, profiled on Australian Story a few months back and really gathered a lot of traction and was well received within the community. And also Yanina Nern, who's the current CEO of Are You OK? Day back in 2008. So we've only been around for just over 3 years now, but in terms of the overall awareness and participation, it's actually incredible how many Australians have got behind this initiative.
Yes, it's such a simple message, isn't it? It's just have a cup of coffee, just ask that very question, which you've put in modern speak, the Are You OK? And it can have dramatic effects on reducing the suicide rate in Australia.
That's right. Unfortunately, every year, more than 2,100 Australians do take their life, and it's a statistic that's way too high. But perhaps even more concerning is the fact that it's not only the number of suicides each year, but there's, for every person who dies in this way, another 30 attempt to take their life. So what we're trying to do at Are You OK Day is our ultimate aim is to actually eradicate suicide in Australia, but it's also about helping stop little problems from becoming bigger. So we want to empower people to have the courage to ask the question, are you okay? Because it can be quite a confronting or even a daunting question to ask. And then if you're the one being asked the question, to then have the courage to say, I'm not okay, if indeed you do need some help.
Yes, and then there's the option of going to one of the various programs that are available for mental health.
That's right. Australia is very blessed in many ways. We have an extraordinary number of programs, many of them funded by the federal government, all about supporting people who are at the very pointy end of mental health issues or suicidal thoughts. And unfortunately, a lot of people actually don't know that these programs exist. A lot of people have heard of Lifeline, for example, which do amazing work, but they might not be as aware of centres like Men's Line, for example, which supports men who are grappling with relationship problems, or Suicide Callback Service, which is staffed by experts in kind of clinical service provision and will do follow-up counselling sessions with people to make sure that they're okay. You've got an absolute plethora of services that are available, and we want to help connect people to those services if indeed they do need them.
Now, this media release today, is that to announce that you will be working closely with Men's Line Australia?
Indeed, that was one of the things that we wanted to announce. We've had a number of conversations with Men's Line Australia. We recognise, based on this year's research, that we are reaching both men and women, but whilst we're reaching more than 60% of women, we're only reaching around 50% of men. It's still a great statistic, but we recognise that we can do more, and so we think by working with experts who kind of have operated in this field for quite some time, we can use their research, we can use their knowledge, and we can also use their contacts to further promote Are You OK Day to what is also quite an at-risk group.
Yes, and you mentioned 65% awareness among women, 50% in males, but the problem, I suppose, is, if anything, it's more with the males than the females.
That's true. I think, you know, just speaking from anecdotal conversations and things like that, I think it's definitely it's easier for women to open up and have those conversations and to admit to struggling with various issues. But I don't think we should discount the fact that women are also play incredible support roles for their husbands, for their fathers, for their sons, for their partners. And so even though the awareness might not be on par across genders, I think by having a really engaged female audience that then has the potential to ensure that the message is kind of spread on to their respective partners, sons and other family members.
Yes, and the looking at those figures for suicide, it says that I've noticed here that suicide is highest for men aged between 25 and 34 and those over 80. I was just a bit surprised at the figures, not surprised at 25 and 34, but surprised at those over 80.
Yeah, it is quite surprising. I think the reason it's not often a headline-grabbing item is if you look at the overall number of deaths amongst that age group, they're actually statistically quite small. So numerically, it's not a shocking number, although proportionally, it is quite a shocking number. As you said in my introduction, I used to work for a federal government program targeting people from non-English-speaking backgrounds. And And suicide and mental health issues amongst older migrants is absolutely rampant. Mm. And the reason is they often feel like they're prisoners in their own home. They lose their, for example, they can actually lose their English language skills, which they might have only developed as an early adult. They can feel quite disconnected from their younger family members because of the cultural divide. So that's just one example of an Australian who might find themselves feeling vulnerable, feeling isolated, feeling lonely as a result of age.
Yes, so look, Are You Okay? Are You Okay is wonderful at getting the message out. I just happened to notice in the weekend edition of the Sydney Morning Herald a photo of Tony Abbott, an immigration spokesman, Scott Morrison, and Scott Morrison is wearing an Are You Okay badge.
I didn't realise that he did that, but that's great news. Yeah. We certainly had incredible buy-in from across the political spectrum this year. I think it needs to be noted that leaders on both sides of politics and indeed also of the minor political parties really took the Are You OK message to heart and championed it amongst their colleagues. And I think the fact that we have, you know, such incredible cross-political support is a further indication that this is indeed a national issue requiring a united response. And all of Australia can get behind this initiative and get involved.
Yes, and I think politics is an area where this is probably particularly relevant. My first guest today was Andrew Robb, who has a well-publicised battle with depression, and he's come out the other side, which is the great news. Now, just going back to Are You OK itself, your founder or your co-founder, Gavin Larkin, unfortunately passed away only a few weeks ago, but he did survive to see this year's Are You OK Day, which was on the 15th of September.
That's right. He did. We were really proud to be able to share the preliminary independent research results with him. He was an incredible. He was an incredible man, but also he really fought to the end. And I personally think that the reason he fought so hard was, obviously, first and foremost, was for his family. But second of all, was to kind of see Are You OK Day through in its third year. Mm. And I think based on this year's results of an overall spontaneous awareness across the population of 58%. He knew before he passed away that Are You OK Day was in safe hands, because
yes,
all of Australia wants to champion it.
Yes, and I see you're on Twitter, you're on Facebook, so you're using the social media to get the message out.
That's correct. And what was quite incredible, and I think this can be partly attributed to Gavin's story, which aired on Australia's Story on ABC, was in the week of Are You OK Day, we had more than 1,000% increase in our Facebook followers. So we started at, you know, under 15,000 at the beginning of the week, and we went up to 170,000 or thereabouts on Are You OK Day. So this absolute explosion of activity on social media, it kind of went viral, which was great, because I think we were able to reach out to a lot of people who may have not been aware of us before that.
Yes, and Gavin Larkin himself is such an inspiring story. His own father committed suicide at a very young age, about, I think, 55. And that was it, really, what got Gavin thinking about doing something about it, I suppose.
That's right. I think Gavin felt firsthand the effects that suicide and the loss of such an amazing, incredible father, he kind of felt the direct effects of that on his life. And he also obviously witnessed the effects of that on his brothers as well. And so for Gavin, he wanted to create awareness about suicide in Australia, and obviously eradicating suicide in Australia, but also about helping people to realise that they don't need to grapple with whatever dark, I guess, secret that they're dealing with alone, and that they can always reach out for help. And if you are in a state of well-being, for example, you also have an obligation to reach out to your colleague, to your mum, to your dad, to your son, to your brother, to whoever it is in your life, and kind of, I guess, be generous with your emotional capacity to deal with issues, and make sure that you support people who might not be doing, you know, who might be going through essentially quite a tough time.
Yes. Now, we've mentioned that that Are You OK Day this year was on the 15th of September. What do you do throughout the rest of the year apart from the Are You OK Day?
Well, because we've gathered such momentum in terms of support, in terms of awareness. We're now really well situated to start to build on that awareness and engagement and have mini initiatives throughout the year. I think some people mistakenly understand Are You Okay Day as this one day that you're meant to ask people in your life, are you okay? That's not the message we're trying to generate at all. We want every day of the year to be Are You Okay Day. And so in order to support our One National Day of Action, which is the second Thursday of September, so next year it'll be September the 13th, we're going to have small kind of initiatives happening. For example, we've actually recently partnered Telstar for the V8 Supercar event. Mm-hmm. And for that, that's a really great opportunity not only to promote the Are You Okay Day message to a very broad cross-section of the community, but also to target some of those at-risk groups, including men and including young people, because they do have basically a youth initiative on the first day. We're also going to be looking at doing initiatives in schools that will kind of more closely reflect the school term. So, for example, HSD time, incredibly stressful yes. for a lot of students. So starting to develop or tailor initiatives, rather, that we currently have to specific times where there might be more stress with particular community groups than at other times of the year.
Yeah, it's very topical. I think the HSC started yesterday in New South Wales, so there's no doubt a lot of stressed young people out there as we speak.
Oh, my heart goes out to them. I can remember all too well what that was like.
Now, I see that there are a number of steps you can take when just so people know what to do in connection with Are You Okay? When you check in with a relative, a friend, or a neighbour, or a colleague, could you just take us through what people should do in that situation?
Sure. I think you know, the phrase "Are you okay?" or "How are you going?" it's become such, I guess, so well entrenched in everyday vernacular that it's kind of this throwaway phrase now. People just go, hey, how are you going? And it's a very kind of off-the-cuff comment. And I think what's important to do is to, first of all, completely reject that tendency just to make it a flippant question or, you know, just, I guess, a casual reaction to seeing someone, and make sure that you actually create the time and space to have a conversation with someone. So the first thing to do is obviously just, you know, approach the person in an environment that they're comfortable in, for example. You know, take them aside, make sure it's not too public, the venue that you're talking about it, because if they do have personal issues that they'd like to share, they're not going to do it in a really noisy street setting, rather. And that you can also ask open questions. So as opposed to saying, you know, do you find what the boss said the other day really confronting? That's just a yes-no question. Maybe ask, how did you feel when the boss held you up as an example the other day? Or how did you feel when such and such said that? So help, I guess, kind of you're leading the conversation with open-ended questions.
Yes.
I think probably the thing that people are most terrified of hearing is, do you know what, mate, I'm really not okay. Because I think there is this mistaken belief out there that by focusing on that person's issues, you're kind of in some way contributing to the problem. It's not true at all. If someone says, I'm not okay, don't freak out. Don't think that you're making the issue worse. Just, again, be there for them as a friend. Ask those questions. And maybe prompt them to take action to make sure that, or to you know, to resolve the situation that they currently find themselves in. So we don't have to be experts to ask this question. I think that that's where the fear comes in. People are so afraid of saying or doing the wrong thing that it stifles conversation.
Yes, and you have some people who have definitely been there and done that. I'm thinking of Graham Cowan, who I think is a director of Are You Okay? Is that correct?
Yes, he is.
And he's had a successful marketing career, but he's also suffered from chronic depression for years, and I think he's had about 4 suicide attempts, but he's managed to come through that and is now doing wonderful work with Are You Okay? And so people like that, you know, when people feel that they're all alone and that no one else has suffered like they have, there are people that they can perhaps make contact with that have been there and can offer some practical support.
Absolutely. And I think we really admire, respect and look up to the people who have come back from the brink, so to say, if, you know, they have actually attempted to take their life, for example, because we really rely on their expertise, their leadership, and also their story to inspire other people that, yes, help is available, yes, I am going through a bad time, that things can get better. So it's because of people like Graham and our many ambassadors who I guess kind of leave themselves open by, you know, sharing such personal aspects of their lives that we really appreciate. And it's because of their efforts and their stories that Are You Okay Day has become as successful as it is.
Yes, I think it's just such a simple message. It's a wonderful message. The Are You Okay, the logo, what you're doing, it doesn't require an enormous commitment. It requires just having an interest in, as we said before, perhaps a cup of coffee in a quiet place, and maybe the furthest it might go might be just to direct them to where help is available. So it's definitely should be supported. And Rebecca, is there? We're speaking with Rebecca Lewis. Rebecca Lewis, who is the project manager of Are You Okay. Rebecca, is there any message you'd like to get out there to people at this very important time of year?
I think for us, you know, regardless of what time of year it is, the message that we always we want to share with people is, you know, well, really the call to action for us is, who will you ask? Who will you ask today? Are you okay? Who will you ask tomorrow? Are you okay? And kind of, who will you ask every day after that? That's the one message that we want to get out there into the community. And, you know, for everyone who's listening who might be struggling with some issue in their life, and look, we all face issues at some point in our lives that we're going to have to grapple with and confront. But to all of those listeners, I just say, look, if you're struggling, you know, turn to someone you can trust. It could be a colleague, it could be a friend, it could be a family member, and just reach out to that person and help them to guide you through whatever you're experiencing.
That's a great message. Thank you, Rebecca. I think we're running out of time, but look, we really appreciate you coming on the program. This is Rebecca Lewis, the project manager of Are You Okay, and we wish you all the very best for the rest of this year and for Are You Okay Day 2012, which will be on Thursday the 13th of September, I think. Is that correct?
Thank you so much. Thank you very much for your time, Bill.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Bye.
Don't let the sun catch you crying, crying at my front door. You done daddy dirty, he sure don't want you no more. Don't let the sun catch you lying, lying at my front door. Daddy's done turned salty, and baby, you made him so sore. You can cry, cry, cry. Yes, baby, you can wail. Beat your head on the pavement. Till a man comes and throws you in jail. Don't let the sun catch you crying, crying at my front door. You done your daddy dirty, I tell you, he just don't want you no more. Thank you.
Don't let the sun catch you lying. Lying at my front door. Daddy's done turned salt in. Baby, you made him so sore. Whoa, you know you done me dirty now. And I just don't want you no more.
Dan's in Distress, meeting your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dan's in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
Welcome back to Dad's on the Air. It's the last time for today. We want to thank our guests who came on the program today, Andrew Robb and Rebecca Lewis. Andrew Robb, the federal member for Goldstein, and Rebecca Lewis from Are You OK? I should also thank Georgie Bain, the marketing and publicity manager from Melbourne University Publishing, and Geordie Purcell, who is the executive assistant to Andrew Robb. So it's been a very interesting show today. Hope you enjoyed it. And, of course, we'll be back next week. But we should mention in the meantime our new website.
Yes, we are now www.dadsontheair.com.au. We've had a change of our web address, so you can be able to download this program sometime later in the day from dadsontheair.com.au. And we'll be back next week.